not calling it quits. I'll keep on working on this. I'm working harder on this. It's plain obvious it is. Oh, dive, dive into you, dive in.
Hi there and welcome. You're listening to the Diving In podcast, brought to you by Virginia Seymour and Louise Jones. This podcast is part of a lifelong conversation between friends about the books we're reading and the issues they make us think about. That also goes for the movies and television we're watching and the podcasts we're currently hooked on. We might even talk about what's in the news and anything else we're diving into this week.
Diving in.
Hello, Louise.
Hello.
Hello, lovely divers. Welcome to episode 73 of the Diving In podcast. Lou and I are recording this conversation on unceded Whadjuk Noongar land in Western Australia, and we acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional custodians of the land. Today, we thought we would look at Dickens, Charles Dickens, through a modern lens, as well as having a chat about two of the OG Dickens works.
I love that.
Lou read one don't think you'd read before.
No, I have read it.
Oh, I have read it before.
Okay, yes.
Okay. So Lou's was a reread, which will be interesting.
Yes.
And I read another, which I had never read. So mine's a first off. So that's quite interesting. And then we both read Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, which is inspired by and parallels David Copperfield. Mm. And we'll talk about that after we've each talked about the original ones. So Lou, kick us off with your.
Yes. Order. So my Charles Dickens' choice was Hard Times, and it is one of my favourite Dickens books, although, as I have confessed to Virginia, I think Dickens is probably possibly my favourite author of all time. This book is set during the rapid wealth creation and huge economic sort of and societal change that follows the Industrial Revolution, as, of course, with many of Dickens' books.
Yeah.
And the characters are sort of totems of Victorian stereotypes. They're often exaggerated, satirical caricatures of their times. And this book is based in a fictional place called Coketown. It's a manufacturing town, and it's covered in black ash from the factories. So it's sort of uniformly drab and black. Dickens has his sort of characteristic fun with names of places and people. And we often talk about that as hallmarks of Dickens. And so many authors, you know, do that now. It's part of his legacy. And look, he's poking fun, but he's also really drawing attention to something serious and reflecting, of course, his own social concerns. So Hard Times opens in a classroom, and the classroom is part of Mr. Thomas Gradgrind's school. He's the superintendent, and he later becomes a local MP. And he stopped past the classroom of one of the teachers, a Mr. Chokum Child.
Oh, God.
And he's lecturing. He started to lecture Mr. Chokum Child's students. And he tells them that the only thing that they need to concern themselves with in life are facts, not with things they might imagine, not with things they may feel, but with cold, hard, incontrovertible facts. And this is his sort of philosophy for education. Not, of course, that he would describe it as a philosophy. It's his system of education. And he's established it for the school, and it's also the system by which he's raised his own two children. So he's got this very insistent, loud and hectoring style of questioning, and he starts questioning the children about facts, you know, what is a horse? And one of the children that falls foul of his methods is a little girl called Sissy Jupe. So Sissy Jupe is not known by her name in the classroom. She's known by her number.
Oh.
She is girl number 20. And as far as Mr. Gradgrind is concerned, she's a failure because she knows no facts. So the children that are going to thrive, obviously, in this school and at life, from his perspective, are the ones that submit to his system. And one of those boys is called Bitzer, and he knows how to curry favour and perform as required. And he has a bit of a part to play in the story later, which I won't go into. So for all the sort of grossness and exaggeration and humour of Mr. Gradgrind, there's this very robotic dystopian feel in this opening part of the book. On his walk home from school, Mr. Gradgrind comes across his two children, Louisa and her younger brother, Tom. And he finds them next to a big top of a circus that's arrived in Coketown. And Louisa is quite bold, and she tells her father she's curious about the circus. And Gradgrind is furious because no child has any business being curious about anything because it's not consistent with the system. And you're left thinking that maybe Louisa has some independence of mind and doesn't entirely subscribe to her father's system. Maybe. And when they get home, there's a visitor waiting, and he turns out to be a central character in the book, another larger than life, literally large, deeply opinionated, self-focused man, and that's Mr. Bounderby. And Bounderby will proclaim to anyone who's listening or not listening, as often as he can, that he is a successful, self-made man, despite a very humble start in life. You know, he came from abject poverty, no education, but here he is, a success story. And he wears it as a badge of honour. What he's really saying is, I started out inferior, but I've done so well and I'm now so much more successful than you. That's the sub story. He also has an unhealthy interest in Louisa, who is much younger than him. She's only 16. So Dickens' portrait of these two men, which sort of take up a lot of the book, is really fascinating. You know, on the face of it, they're described as best friends, but I just got the sense it's a friendship of convenience. They're the two men in the town occupying positions of power. They pump each other up with sort of superficial compliments and niceties. Bounderby is a factory owner and a banker, and so he employs much of the town. And Gradgrind is actually a little bit in awe of him, but of course Bounderby is probably staying around because of Louisa. And then circumstances conspire, which I won't go into, and Sissy Jupe, whose father works for the circus, moves in with the Gradgrinds. And Gradgrind think it'll be good for her and it'll be good for her, for his own children. And she's a significant character at the start of the book, and she has an interesting side story, but we hear relatively little from her for most of the book until towards the end. And I think that that's by design, because from the moment she enters the Gradgrind house, she sort of becomes companion to Louisa and Tommy's mum, who's unwell. Really, she becomes a servant. And that invisibility that she has in the story and just generally is commensurate with her position in life and in the household.
Yeah.
And the Gradgrind children have their own problems, so she's not their focus. But quietly, she's very observant and very interested and concerned about them, which is also true of, I suppose, in the Victorian era, household staff.
Yes.
Ended up knowing more.
Yes.
You know, because they're seeing everything, aren't they? Mm. Seeing and hearing everything,
it's
but not
world.
Saying it's their world. Tom Gradgrind is not a nice boy at all. I think that's fairly obvious from the beginning, so I'm not giving too much away there. Both he and Louisa retreat from their father's philosophy into their own sort of interior worlds, but they've got different ways of coping. Tom is a gambler and a wastrel.
Oh.
And the only way he can support that lifestyle and his debts is access to job and money. And, of course, he identifies that Mr. Bounderby could offer him that lifestyle, and he knows Mr. Bounderby will do anything for Louisa. So he manipulates his sister.
Wow.
And she agrees to marry Bounderby.
Oh, my Lord.
I first read Hard Times when I was much younger. I've read it again since. But I remember the first time I read it, I must have been, I don't even know if I was in my teens or early 20s. I was so disappointed with Louisa. Like, I remember taking it personally. I felt that she'd settled for Bounderby, but I don't think I appreciated then how damaged and underdeveloped Louisa and Tom are as a result of their upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you think about the impact of depriving children, and this is a theme that is, you know, prevalent in the books we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely.
And the Barbara Kingsolver book. You know, if you deprive children of their childhood, of imaginative play and make-believe, and it has disastrous effects. For Louisa, it's not too high a price. She's swapping her father's household for Bounderby's household.
What other choices did she have?
And she's learned not to have high expectations for herself, and she loves her brother, you know. So while the Gradgrinds are concerned with their sort of domestic affairs in Coketown, ordinary people are dealing with their own issues. And the book moves to focus on the workers at Bounderby's factory that are known, again, it's very handmaiden's tale. It's very dystopian. They're known simply as hands.
Oh.
Because they are effectively Mr. Bounderby's hands doing his work. And there's a character, Stephen Blackpool, one of the workers, and he is an older man and he wears this huge amount of stress on his face. And, you know, we learn that he has a difficult home life. He has a friend at the factory, a young woman, Rachel. They are just friends, but they have great affection for each other. And she tries to help him out with, you know, his difficult life at home, which I'm not going to spoil. Stephen Blackpool does reach out to Bounderby for help and advice as to what he can do, but Bounderby just dismisses him. And so Hard Times really reflects this huge unrest in this period, the emerging labour and trade movement union, you know, protesting against work conditions in the 1800s. So I'll just leave it and say trouble is on the horizon for Mr. Bounderby. The main points of tension and drama in the book build up in relation to two things. There's a mysterious woman who's lurking around Coketown with an unusual interest in one of the main characters. I'm not going to mention who. And around the same time, there's also an incident that takes place at the bank where Tom Gradgrind works. And that has serious consequences for a number of the characters. Let's just say the systems of fact and logic and reason that Mr. Gradgrind is so attached to a very little help to deal with human fallacy and the problems that people create. It's actually a fairly simple story. It's obviously a period of upheaval in Britain. The character of people is tested. And because Dickens' characters are so vivid and so complete, they're not that different to the character tests that people face.
Yeah.
Today, you know, and I think that's why his books are still so wonderful to read.
Yeah.
So that's me.
Gee, listening to you talk about that, and I have read it and it's my memory of it is very hazy. I've been watching North and South.
Right.
An adaptation of the Elizabeth Gaskell.
I've seen it.
Gosh, it's very similar themes. And Elizabeth Gaskell, I think, was a good friend or was mentored by Dickens, I seem to recall.
Yeah, wow.
And there are some strong similarities there with the owner of the mill and the uprising
Trouble
of the, and
Trouble
the union movement and workers and all those sort of things. So, we've somehow ended up in a particular little zone today, haven't we?
We have. We have because we have picked these books without
it's
regard
funny how
for
everything else sort of happens as well.
Because I picked Hard Times before we before I'd read Demon Clubhead.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So I decided to read Oliver Twist only because I am going to try and read Dickens' books in order.
Yes, that's a great idea.
And I have read, I think his first one was The Pickwick Papers, which I loved. And I have read Hard Times and Tale of Two Cities and a few others, but I'm going to literally work my way through in the order that he wrote them.
Can I just ask you before you start, did he serialise all of his books?
I don't know if they were all done that way. I mean,
because the,
most were, I think.
Yeah, because the propulsive nature of the stories and the plots does sort of lend itself to, and here's the next instalment.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just interested to know.
Yeah. Well, I did read something about the plotting of the Charles Dickens one that I read, so I'll come to that actually because it's, I think he got better at the plotting. But anyway, I had never read this and I'd not even seen the movie. So I only knew from sort of just cultural references the, you know, please, sir, I want some more with the bowl of gruel, that scene.
Oh, it's such an amazing story.
And I knew that there was a criminal named Fagin and that there are lots of low life. So I sort of generally knew the plot but not the fine detail of it.
Nancy.
So this was written in, I'm going to come to Nancy because she is absolutely my favourite character in the whole thing. So this was written in 1837, which was the year that Queen Victoria ascended the throne. So this book is actually, to me, more pre-Victorian. It's older than the Victorian.
Yeah.
I think now we probably wouldn't think of the Victorian era as a more modern era, but a lot of things changed around that time. This is even older, I think. King William was still on the throne when he started writing this. And like most or all, and we don't know, of Dickens' novels, it was published in a serial form over, I think, about 18 months or so, sort of spanned 1837, and I think the final books were published in 1839, and there were lots of changes. The edition that I've got, the chapters are slightly different from other editions, because I think there were changes as different iterations came out. And I'm not going to say too much about the plot, because I think that's something that you should get to enjoy for yourself. But there are some general things about it that I really loved. It's one of his shorter novels. It's only 53 chapters, 450-odd pages. It's very doable if you want to start reading a Dickens. And it opens with the birth of Oliver Twist in a workhouse to a young mother who was not a resident of the workhouse, and she wasn't known to the people running the workhouse. She had been found collapsed in the street with very tattered shoes, so they knew she had travelled some distance and she was close to giving birth. And importantly for 1837, she was not wearing a wedding ring.
Okay. Yeah.
And shortly after giving birth, she dies. So Oliver is then completely alone in the world. No one knows who his family might be or even what part of England he might be from. And his prospects in life are not good at all. His chances of ever finding his family seem very slim. And he's farmed out to another workhouse, which is a more suitable one, has lots of juvenile offenders. And then he's moved around a bit. And then eventually he falls into the circle of Fagin.
Mm.
And Fagin is a criminal who teaches young boys that have no families, and actually girls as well, how to pick pockets and steal, and he then fences the stolen goods. And that is what he tries to teach young Oliver. And that gang of criminals includes a young guy called Jack Dawkins, who is the Artful Dodger. Was there ever such a great name for
amazing,
a criminal?
Amazing.
And there's a horrible man named Sykes and his lady friend Nancy.
Mm.
So Oliver is almost wrongly convicted of pickpocketing by a police magistrate named Mr. Fang. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
And Oliver is rescued very fortuitously by a kindly man who's at one point described as having the hearts of six kind men, Mr. Brownlow. And Mr. Brownlow takes Oliver in and looks after him, because after this experience of almost being convicted, Oliver sort of collapses. He's been having a terrible time and he becomes very ill. He sort of almost faints away into a bit of a coma. They take him in, put him to bed, and the lovely housemaid looks after him. And it's at the residence of Mr. Brownlow that coincidence comes into play. And the reader is drip-fed little clues as to the significance of Mr. Brownlow, but it takes until the end of the book for it all to be revealed.
Yeah.
And this is probably where the weakness of the book comes in. I mean, I know London was a much smaller place in 1837, so the sorts of coincidences that Dickens includes may well have been possible.
It is the theme with his books, though, that sort of circling round, re-meeting people.
But they are very clumsily contrived coincidences. And I suspect it might be because of the serialised nature of the story. This is only his second book.
Yeah.
And I think he probably got better at plotting the story out.
Yes.
And putting in all the little foretellings and foreshadowings.
Yes.
And before he starts his first episode in the serial, working out the sort of the architecture of the thing and where he's going to tell you something that happens later. And I suspect he didn't tell us a lot of things in the beginning that he needed to.
Yes.
And they've already gone out into the world and now we've got to find out how things happen. So that's quite an interesting issue for him in this one, I think.
There is a slight thing, I think, with some of his books of him thinking he knows better than the reader, though. So there's a little bit of an angle of that as well, especially if he's doing it to a serialized audience that's sort of hungry for the next installment.
Yeah.
There is a bit of a superiority, you know.
Like, I'm going to give you.
Yes. I know better than you, and not trusting his audience a little bit. Authors learn to do.
Yeah. I mean, I can't give examples because it would totally.
Yes.
If you haven't read Oliver Twist.
Yes. No, fair enough.
My examples would just spoil the enjoyment of it, because they are very much about how people connect up to one another.
Yes, fair enough. I'm going to have to go back and read it now and work that out myself.
Yeah. So I did have to draw myself a diagram. to figure out all the connections between the characters, which I loved doing. You know, I love a map.
Yes, you sure do.
I love a family tree. You know, it's not work for me. I just love doing it.
Yeah.
I didn't quite get it all from a first read of the text. And some people don't have the same name in one circumstance as they might have had in another, a little bit like The Count of Monte Cristo. So you're sort of reading thinking, oh, I think this person might actually be whatever. And the baddies who appear in Mr. Fagin's Den of Thieves continue into that arm of the story, and events build and build, and it's a very dramatic and violent crescendo for many of them. It has quite an impact on you. The anti-Semitism is a bit of an issue because in this case Fagin is described as a Jew, and he's given the most horrible words of description about him.
Yeah.
But to me, they were more a fairly accurate social mirror. And although they're very jarring to read in 2024, I just don't think you could blame Charles Dickens for being anti-Semitic any more than any other person in society at that time. I think it's probably just a reflection of how most people were in London, unfortunately, in the early part of the 19th century, or even all of the 19th century.
They'd expelled all the Jews in the 1200s from London, and then I think they came back in the 1600s. Yeah. So there was a lot of anti-Semitism.
And there was a very famous criminal called Ikey, someone or other, who was a Jewish man who was a very polished man, as I understand, but I don't know if Fagin's based on him, but, you know, that was certainly a perception at the time.
Yes, very unfortunate.
And it's interesting because whilst it's clear that Dickens wrote this as a social criticism in relation to the treatment of the poor, I don't think that he intended his anti-Semitism to be a social critique, but that's actually what it's become.
Yes, no, absolutely.
which is quite ironic.
Yeah.
The other thing that's, you know, very much an underlying theme here is the death penalty, and it makes very interesting reading from that point of view. It's in every scene, really. It's an underlying issue. Even the name of Twist for his surname, because to twist is another word for hanging. And that was like,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So there's a lot of words that we used as meaning that you were going to hang, and certainly people in the book predict that Oliver Twist is going to hang and that he's going to become amount to nothing and also because of the early circumstances of his life. The social commentary on the poor laws are also a very significant aspect of the book. So they had been enacted slightly earlier, and there's very much sort of a holding a mirror up to what they have produced and what they are going to produce in the next generation. Very much a philosophy of every man having to look out for number one. That's even a quote in the book. I think it might be Fagin saying, I'm not going to look out for number two, and you've got to look out for number one, which is a phrase we still use today, a bit like one of those Shakespeare phrases. So that was also very interesting to read. But for me, Nancy is the most complex and interesting character in the book. So Nancy is she's not overtly described as a prostitute, but all the surrounding evidence is that she is a prostitute, and she is the partner of Sid, who is another horrible criminal. Dickens' examination of women prostitutes in the 19th century or through her.
Yes.
And she's not a major character, but the parts where she appears are so poignant and revelatory. Nancy is a young woman who has been in the control of Fagin since she was even younger than Oliver. So she was obviously without family, without friends, and she started off being taught how to steal for Fagin. She's completely in the control of men, like Sykes and Fagin. She's probably an alcoholic. There's a scene where she's very, very drunk and just in complete despair. And her life is just one of abject misery. And although she's very hardened by her life experiences, she does show some kindness to Oliver. And she does have a good heart. And, I mean, she's described in some articles by academics as the tart with a heart and that sort of thing, which I suppose is a catchy way of describing it.
but rather superficial.
Yeah. I think the way he describes female rage through the vehicle of Nancy's character is absolutely brilliant. And I just thought I'd read a couple of little bits because he's just, oh my God, it's so good. So on page 131, he says, there is something about a roused woman, especially if she adds all her other strong passions, the fierce impulses of recklessness and despair, which few men like to provoke. And then later on she says, I thieved for you. She's talking to Fagin. I thieved for you when I was a child, not half as old as this, pointing to Oliver. I have been in the same trade and in the same service for 12 years since. Don't you know it? Speak out. Don't you know it? Then it goes on, and she's absolutely building up to an absolute rage. The girl said nothing more but tearing her hair and dress in a transport of frenzy, made such a rush at the Jew as would probably have left signal marks of her revenge upon him, had not her wrists been seized by Sykes at the right moment, upon which she made a few ineffectual struggles and fainted. And there's just quite a bit of that throughout it, and you can just feel that this woman has been
exploited.
Her life is sheer horror. She's just been at the hands of men and that patriarchal society that she finds herself in amidst the poor laws and the lack of, you know, social reform. I actually could have read a whole book about Nancy.
Yeah.
She's such a minor character in the book, but I just thought it's not often that I think a man captures a woman very well. Sometimes they do, of course, but
I remember being very distressed reading it when I was younger. When I first read Oliver Twist, very distressed about, you know, the plight she found herself in. You know, I think Oliver Twist is a very serious Dickens book compared to some of his others.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think of this one that I've, Hard Times, which I still think is brilliant, it's just not as serious.
Yeah. Some of them he's just trying to be funny.
I don't mean all well ends well. I don't mean that. There's obviously still serious things that are in it. But Oliver Twist is just much more layered.
Yeah. And he very clearly had something he wanted to say, as he did with David Copperfield.
Yes.
So I really enjoyed this. I thought it could be a bit shorter, to be perfectly honest, even though it is quite a short book. And it's not quite as well plotted as the later ones that I have read.
Mm-hmm.
But I really liked the things that Dickens had to say. So that was Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens.
Excellent. Makes me want to go back and read it.
Yeah, it's really worth a read. So now we're going to talk about the modern iteration of David Copperfield, which is a book by Barbara Kingsolver called Demon Copperhead. And you were going to kick us off, Lou.
Yes, I thought I might just mention a bit about her and what she has to say about her home in Kentucky, in Appalachia, particularly how Appalachia and the experience of the people and communities there and still there, have informed the writing of this book. And you can listen to her talking about this on Ezra Klein's podcast. It's a really interesting interview. And I particularly think for those of us who don't live in America, you know, we hear a lot about culture wars and issues that are going to be raised by this book. But I think we have quite a superficial understanding of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's really useful to hear from somebody who lives in that region, and particularly a writer.
Yeah.
So she's a much awarded and respected American writer. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Demon Copperhead, but she's also author of many other books. I've only read The Poisonwood Bible and The Lacuna. I haven't read anything else.
I think I've read three.
Yeah.
I've read one other. I've read those two and one other.
I'm definitely going to, you know, when time permits.
Yeah.
Go back and read some more. She's written poetry and essays, and she's also written creative nonfiction. She was awarded the National Humanities Medal, which is America's highest honour for service through the arts, and she still lives with her family on a farm in southern Appalachia. So I want to just quote what she actually says about Appalachia. She says, Appalachia is a region that is a little hard to pin down on a map because it includes parts of lots of states, starting from North Georgia, Eastern Tennessee, Western North Carolina and Virginia, up into the coal country of Kentucky and West Virginia and Pennsylvania. So the region touches 18 states, which is extraordinary. She says, that sounds complex, But to us, it's a whole place, and we're more connected with each other culturally and geographically than we are with the other parts of our states. So it's a mindset. Being Appalachian is a mindset. We're connected by our mountains, our economies, and the fact that for a couple of centuries, we've been treated almost like an internal colony of the US. We've suffered the exploitation of extractive industries managed by outside companies that come in and take what they can and leave a mess behind. It started out with the timber industry, then it was coal, then it was tobacco, and the latest exploitation has been the opioid epidemic, which was perpetrated on us as a vulnerable population. So she talks also about the visual stereotypes that are perpetrated from about people who come from this region of America. In the press, in television, you know, she said, essentially, we were considered dumb hillbillies. That's the cultural norm. She was teased at college, you know, how can you live there? And more recently, the charge is, how can you live in MAGA country? But in the context of Demon Copperhead, she wanted to talk about why Appalachia became the perfect storm for Big Pharma. She says that Appalachia is isolated, obviously. So healthcare delivery is stretched to the bare minimum. But because of the influence and the impact of the extractive industries, this has resulted in a higher than normal injured and disabled population. And so consequently, they are not looked after by, there's a huge service gap for the, for those people. So the principal consequence of that is there's no such thing as a follow-up appointment with a doctor. You might see a doctor once and you'll get a prescription, and prescription pattern medicine is the norm. And the doctors were all told that the opioids were safe. So there are just countless people living prescription by prescription, and it's either killed them or it's left them in rehab with addiction. And the consequence of that, of course, is a generation of orphans. Who've been left behind. And she points out that the public school system is essentially being asked to raise all these kids. The public schools are the pretty much the point of delivery for all of the social services that the kids get, for their food, for their mental health, for their counselling. And the schools can't cope.
No.
And she said basically people outside of the region just don't appreciate that about Appalachia. So what she wanted to do with the story was to tell this not from the point of view of Big Pharma, not from the point of view of doctors. She wanted to tell this from the point of view of the children. And she refers to them as the survivors. And, yeah, she refers to Charles Dickens as the ghost in the room because there were such strong parallels.
Yeah.
He, of course, talks about orphans all the time,
as you've just pointed out. Absolutely.
So it's probably a good time for you to tell us a little bit about the book.
Okay. It's such a clever book. I haven't read David Copperfield, but I had it beside me and I noticed that she has done such a clever job in paralleling. It's got exactly the same number of chapters.
Yeah.
I think the arc of the story is probably similar. I can't wait to read it now just to compare the names, the characters and the impact they have and the way they interconnect with each other. And yet to transport that from the 1800s in Britain, which is a completely different type of society to modern day America, is incredibly clever.
Yeah.
I'm quite in awe of how she accomplished it. I know that Charles Dickens said that David Copperfield was one of his most personal books.
Yes.
And you could probably say the same for Barbara Kingsolver. It is a very, Demon Copperhead is a very personal book, and she clearly knows her subject.
Yeah.
So this is a, I would describe it as a Bildungsroman or a coming-of-age story about a young boy. His name is officially Damon Fields, but he's nicknamed Demon. Everybody gets a nickname in this place, and he's given the surname Copperhead for his copper-coloured hair. His father's died, and his mother was a very young girl when she had him. She was a teenager. She's a drug user, and she's drawn to a very unsavory guy who becomes Demon's evil stepfather. And so the book covers Demon's life from his birth right through about 300 different twisty turns and many different homes.
Yeah.
And he goes through the foster care system, which is just hell on earth, and encounters really the very worst people and families.
He sure does.
Many of whom take him in only because they want the foster care checks every month. and they don't want to have to spend it on him. It does sound depressing, and it certainly has many dark episodes, but it is ultimately a story of survival against the odds.
Yes.
And it's so beautifully written and told, and you're so in tune with young Demon and willing him to survive and to not even just survive but to thrive. So he's very much the hero of the story, and you're just always wanting him to surmount the innumerable challenges that come his way. He starts life in a trailer in Lee County in Virginia. It's a very deprived neighbourhood. He has many natural advantages that a lot of other people don't have. He's clever. Yeah. He has his father's very striking good looks. His father was a Melangian, which is a mix of Indian and Portuguese and all sorts of interesting looks. So they're very dark-skinned and very striking, very athletic. Demon is very likeable. He has a very rare artistic talent. He can draw in a very clever way. He grows very tall, and he reveals an outstanding athletic talent and becomes a football tight end.
Mm.
Picture Travis Kelce, who is a tight end. So they're all the things in his plus column, but the items in his negatives column, none of his own making, are very significant. He's dirt poor. He's an orphan. He's a child, so he has no agency and he has no relatives. He has no really good mentors or people in his corner. There's maybe one or two average people, I suppose, who do their best, but it's not that great. And he really encounters some of the most venal, despicable people deliberately using and mistreating him. And even when he appears to have some luck come his way and the reader gets a bit hopeful, it most often doesn't quite work out in his favour. And so the debit column never quite gets to outstrip the credit column. We don't want to give away the plot.
No.
So I just thought I might just mention a couple of the characters that really struck me or that were sort of interesting. There's a family that live, they're actually the people who own the trailer that his mother rented. They're not wealthy themselves. They're not even probably, they're only just making ends meet themselves, I would say, called the Peggotts. And as is often the case with these sort of things, the next door neighbours are the people in closest proximity to Demon and his mother, and therefore the people most able to help. And thank goodness for them. But their resources were very limited, and they were only ever going to be able to do so much for him. And they sort of did as much as they could, but it wasn't enough. They have a rather wonderful adult daughter who's sort of the shining star of the family, named June.
Yeah.
And she's sort of a real hero of the story. She's just wonderful. But she never quite manages to be the person who can give Demon the leg up that could make all the difference to him.
Well, he's not her priority.
Her efforts are directed elsewhere.
Yeah.
So you can see her goodness and her potential, but her energies are going in a different direction. So that's quite frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
I suspect there might be a character like that in David Copperfield. I'm not sure, but that's an interesting one to watch. Then there's the character of Stoner, which is the horrible man that Demon's mother marries. Oh, my goodness.
And there is a Mr. Stonehouse in David Copperfield.
And, I mean, the use of the word stoner and with all the drugs and everything
is
so clever and so fortuitous. So Stoner is both a caricature of the evil, violent husband to Demon's mother and an evil, violent stepfather to Demon, but also completely believable.
Yeah.
He's just very familiar, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He's just a terrible sort of obstacle in Demon's way. And then we sort of get rid of him and more obstacles come in the way. There is one couple that are just wonderful, which are Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong. Well, she's called Ms. Annie, and they are the year 9 teacher and his wife, the art teacher. And this couple just personify that experience many of us have where a particular teacher stands out and they're someone who has impacted us for the better, inspired us to pursue something that really interested us, or they saw something in us and we knew that they got us. And this couple just exemplify everything that's good about teachers. I loved their role. But once again, there's a limit to what they could do because they are just teachers in a school system doing their best, being inspiring. But as to whether they can actually make a real difference on the ground, it was pretty limited.
Yeah, I like those two characters very much. And of course, there's a lot of circling back to some of these characters in his life as he grows up.
Yeah.
I was trying to work out, we sort of have him between 10 and 17, don't we? Or a bit older, 10 and 19.
Yeah.
Is that sort of the period that the book spans, doesn't it, really?
I'd say he's just sort of reached adulthood by the end.
By the end, yeah. I thought I'd talk about a couple of characters too. You know, at some point he does set out to try and connect with his father's family. He had a father that he never knew, as you pointed out, and I'm not going to go into how that all happens, but circumstances coalesce and he finds himself being placed to live in the home of Coach Winfield.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that we're super familiar with, the sort of cultural awe with which coaches of football, college and high school football teams are held in America. It's not part of our cultural fabric here. So I find that absolutely fascinating. Coach Winfield's a widower and he lives with his daughter, who's a similar age to Demon. I think she might be a year older. Her name is Agnes, very significant character in David Copperfield, but she calls herself Angus. And she's smart and she seems pretty self-assured. I don't know about you, but I found in this book, I had to keep putting the book down when it got very confronting. I think I'm getting too old for some of these stories.
There's just so much trauma.
Yeah, you need a break as a reader with this book.
You really do.
But then also Barbara Kingsolver provides us with narrative breaks as well. And so this is one of those breaks living in Coach Winfield's house. There's a young lady that comes to the house to cook and clean. Coach Winfield is fairly absent as a parent, but it means that Angus and Demon get on and do things by themselves. And it's a period, I think, of relative stability in his life. He's slow to trust people, obviously, because he thinks someone's soon going to be there to take him away again. But he sort of does build this rather lovely friendship with Angus. They banter. He's curious about her. They've got the loss of their mothers in common. They increasingly share things. It's probably the most honest and closest relationship he's had so far in his life at this point, don't you think?
It's the best part of the
book. It's the best part of the book. And I feel that he kind of grows up a bit when he's in there, and the stability enables him to do that. And he is then able to start to see things from different perspectives. And although the book takes lots of different turns and twists, as you say, before the book finishes, this is quite a redemptive time. And I say that because it can always be a point of reference for him.
Yes.
If you're the right sort of personality, if you've had a really positive period in your life when the chips are down, you can always refer back to it. So I think that does work for him. As I said, it really gave me time to have a bit of a break.
Yeah.
You know, it's so confronting to see things through Demon's eyes. And so you're just relieved that he's sleeping on clean sheets.
Yeah.
And he's got regular meals in his tummy.
Bedroom.
You know?
Yeah.
And the only other thing I'd say about Angus is she's a truth teller in Demon's life. She's sort of the truth teller. I should mention U-Haul, who's one horrible person hanging around the Winfield household. He's this very creepy, obsequious young man who calls himself the assistant coach, but he's actually just the person that schleps the equipment, isn't he, really? He is Barbara Kingsolver's Uriah Heep, and he hates Demon. He resents Demon's sort of growing football prowess and popularity, and I suspect he resents the relationship with Angus as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you talked about coincidence earlier, because obviously that is, you know, a real feature of Dickens novels, and we could probably map all of Dickens novels and all of the coincidences and chart whether they're believable or not.
Yes.
So characters pop up, and Barbara Kingsolver actually talks about this in the Ezra Klein interview.
Okay.
So it's quite interesting. Okay. And I think she does it in this book because it serves to emphasize community and neighborhoods and that people know each other.
Yeah.
So when Demon's 10, he's sent, as you mentioned, to foster care. Well, I mean, it's obviously moved from foster care to foster care. But this particular foster care is Creaky's Tobacco Farm. He's there with a workforce of foster boys. I found this part of the book really difficult to read.
Oh, my God. It was like Amityville Horror.
It was just unbelievable, wasn't it? So Demon gets to know Sterling Ford, or Fast Ford as he's known. Oh, my God. What? For all the vileness of this character, what a brilliant name.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's an older foster boy. Demon looks up to him. He's impressed by him. He's a football star. And, you know, Demon's 10. He's charismatic. And, you know, and Demon's impressionable then. But when Demon meets, fast forward years later, there are glimpses of sort of a few more sociopathic tendencies.
He sees what he really is.
Yeah. But what I find fascinating is, you know that about Fast Forward, even when he's in the foster care.
Yes.
Like as a reader.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yet Demon is the narrator. So I think that's so clever of a writer. Yes. Demon is the narrator.
Yeah. I love it when
But he's not seeing what he's saying.
Yeah,
he's not saying what he's seeing. I don't know.
He's telling you what the facts are. He's telling you what he's seeing, but then his interpretation is different from the reader's.
Yeah.
The reader's going,
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I just think that's genius. I think it's genius.
Yeah.
The gloss obviously has fallen off Fast Forward when Demon meets him later. He doesn't like the way Fast Forward treats people, particularly women. He can tell he's a bit unhinged and menacing, and he starts to look through Fast Forward through a different lens. And look, Demon has become popular in his own right. He's not perfect. He's still inhabiting a really dysfunctional world. But it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
He has a stronger sense of himself.
It's all relative.
Yeah. So that's Fast Forward. Again, repulsive.
Yeah.
I was scared of Fast Forward.
Yeah.
But still fabulous.
Because of his shininess on the outside, he's more dangerous than the Uriah Heep character, U-Haul.
Yes.
Because U-Haul just looks what he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can see it, but you can see that other people
Fast
are.
Forward's got a bit more Oliver Twist characteristic. No, I mean, not Oliver Twist. There's more characters in Oliver Twist that, to me, feel Fast Forward-like.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's interesting because he's quite evil.
He is quite evil.
Yeah. Then the last character that I want to talk about is Tommy, who's just utterly divine.
Yeah.
Tommy first meets Demon also at Creaky's foster farm home. I should say, this foster home, basically the farmer, as you said, uses the foster system to get cheap labour. And he uses the money that he gets from the Department of Social Services to pay for his farm taxes. And he barely feeds the children. You know, like they're starved.
And then he gets rid of them once his taxes are paid.
Once his taxes are paid. So Tommy and Demon become great friends. Tommy's obviously not Fast Forward. He's got no edge to him at all. He's surprisingly soft-natured for what he's been through. I didn't find that completely believable.
No, maybe not.
So, but maybe he was just this naive kid.
Yeah.
He's a large boy and he predicts, oh, so sad. He says, no one will ever want me because I'm a fat kid. I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that's true of the foster system.
Yeah, possibly.
And in spite of his melancholy, he always looks on the bright side. And best of all, he introduces Demon to books.
Yes.
He squirrels away all these library books from school and hides them under his bed. And they lose touch, inevitably. But Demon bumps into him when he's picking up a prescription from a pharmacy, and Tommy is the janitor at the pharmacy. And Tommy and Demon fall into their friendship again. Tommy really encourages Demon to return to his art, because he used to scribble when they were in the foster farm together.
He brings out the best in him, doesn't he?
He does bring, absolutely. That's a great way of describing it, Ginny. And he later collaborates with him on some cartoons and illustrations for a newspaper that Tommy starts working for, and they eventually produce a weekly comic. Look, through his relationship and discussions back and forth with Tommy and the ideas for the comic, I think it's a way that Barbara Kingsolver allows us as readers to explore Appalachia social history, because, of course, they're sharing themes and opinions. You know, even when they're prevented from being together physically, Demon and he stay in contact through email.
Yeah.
And so for me, this was the character that allowed Demon to grow intellectually in the same way that his relationship with Angus allows him to grow emotionally.
Yes.
So I thought Tommy has a great role to play.
He really does.
In this. Yeah, look, it was so traumatic, so confronting, so sad.
Yeah.
So funny at times.
We could talk about this for hours, I think, because there are so many more episodes, there's a whole chapter where he comes in contact with an elderly family member and
yes,
very weird things happen. There's another relationship that he has that's, oh my God, I don't even know where to start with some of them.
Yes.
We could be here for hours. There's so much to talk about. And it stays with you, doesn't it?
It does. And I think it's because he's a very vivid narrator. You know, the character is a very vivid narrator.
Yeah.
Like, I felt he was talking to me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, there's the poverty, toxic man, you talked about stoner.
Yeah.
I mean, this toxic masculinity is a big thing, fast forward and stoner. The other thing also is it sounds all doom and gloom, but Barbara Kingsolver is also telling us about community. She's telling us about this beautiful place.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful countryside with clean air and clean water. She's also celebrating where she lives as well a bit, isn't she?
Yeah, definitely.
So it's not all doom and gloom.
No, and that impetus to survive that's in him is the energy that drives the story forward.
Yes, it's very strong.
And you are so rooting for this kid. And that's a testament to the way she's written his character. You don't give up on him, even though he, you know, he goes down some terrible burrows. I did become a little bit exhausted by all the trauma about two-thirds of the way through. As you mentioned, I just had to take a bit of a break because I just thought, because I had thought, oh, he's reached a good spot. He's living with the coach and this will be a springboard and more things happen.
I did also have David Copperfield in my head, so it was a little bit, I knew that there were several hurdles.
Yes, we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. And it was just like, please, dear God, not again.
I really loved the ending. It was very well signposted
in the
book.
It was, actually.
Nonetheless, I still really loved it.
Yeah.
And I really would recommend it. I just think it's got so much in it. And the writing is just fabulous. I think she's incredibly clever.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. I just absolutely loved it. It's going to be near the top of the list for 2024. Yeah,
for sure. Mm. So that was Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. What else have you been diving into recently, Lou?
Well, you'll be pleased to know that we finally started Slow Horses. We're probably the last household on the planet to watch that show.
So speaking of things Dickensian, is there any better modern example of a Dickensian character than Jackson Lamb?
Absolutely brilliant.
With the lank, greasy hair,
He's brilliant.
The clothes, the way he eats and sleeps. He's straight out of Dickens.
He's also very clever, very funny. He's absolutely brilliant.
Very cynical, very smart.
Yeah. Brilliant.
He's on to everybody.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant.
I find it a little bit too masculine for me, and there's a little bit too much gratuitous. I mean, we've just done season three.
Well, we are literally four episodes into season one.
Okay.
We're very early.
Okay.
Yes.
Season three, there's a lot of shooting and a lot of gratuitous violence.
I was surprised at how serious it is.
Very serious.
Yeah,
it's very cynical as well.
Yeah, for something that's so funny, it's
and to have one agency that are so at war internally is depressing. It is depressing to me.
Well, it's just they can't get their SHIT together.
Yeah.
You know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
But what we also binged, we sort of did it two episodes at a time. My husband wouldn't let me continue it. He'd say, no, that's enough for the night. We've just watched the Netflix series One Day starring Leo Woodall.
I just can't. I'm going to do it, but I have to be in a good place.
Yes. So it stars Leo Woodall as Dexter and Ambika Mod as Emma Morley. I'll just give you a quick précis. They're young university students that meet when they're both in their final year at Edinburgh University. They meet at a graduation party and they spend the night together. That's not a spoiler. They're very different young people, and on the face of it, even they couldn't imagine being friends, I don't think. He's a posh, privileged white boy who comes from old money with absolutely no idea what he's going to be doing. She's an Indian girl from the north of England. She's serious, she's hardworking, and she's ambitious to change the world. They irritate each other deeply, and yet they're drawn to each other. And the next day they spend together is 15th of July, 1988. It's very prescient for you and I because it's our sort of uni era. The 15th of July is St. Swithin's Day. And according to folklore, whatever the weather is like on St. Swithin's Day, whether rain or sunshine, it will continue for the next 40 days and 40 nights. That's the myth of St. Swithin's Day. And then you follow them and you follow them meeting every year on St. Swithin's Day. I will not say any more. It's superb and quite serious too.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen people sobbing and all sorts of things on social media. So,
oh, that's interesting. Okay. What about you? What have you been diving into?
We've also been watching Slow Horses. We've done series three, so we've got one more to go. Mm. And I found myself bizarrely doing this total immersion in Emma by Jane Austen.
Mm. I've seen on social media, Virginia.
And it's not something I've ever done before. But it all started because I listened to the audiobooks to go to sleep and Juliet Stevenson is reading me Emma, and then we came to a character who spoke to me. I felt very seen by Jane Austen, and then I thought, oh, I really need to go back and read this. So I've actually been reading it really closely and highlighting it and reading it much more closely than I've ever read a Jane Austen book. And it's so rewarding to do because there are so many great sentences and I'm getting so much more out of it. It's my current, well, nothing will ever beat Persuasion, but it is my current favourite. And then I sat down to watch something and ended up watching the Romola Garay series as well, which just added to the whole thing. So it's just been huge fun.
And nice to do a deep dive, every aspect of it. Yeah.
So that's what I've been diving into. Now, I did have to update you on the ick register.
Yes, brilliant.
If you don't know what the ick register is, you might want to go back and listen to the last episode. but a clue is that if you use the word panties in a sex scene, you are going on the ick register. And I've got two entries for you. You're just going to die, Louise, when the first one is Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead. I think there's two references to panties.
Yes.
I'm sorry, but Barbara, you're on the ick register.
But to be fair, that is very 1980s. Well, it's 1990s, to be honest. It's 1990s, don't you think? I mean, it's 1990s.
She's going on the register. I just went, oh, my God. Much and all as I love
everything about it. We're not even allowed the word in its contextual era.
Well, you know, it gives you the ick. Now you're going to die when I show you my other one.
Yeah, go on.
I'm going to hold it up for you. Peter Temple, Bad Debts.
Really?
He uses it twice.
Really?
I know.
But that's his. Now, that's interesting because to him, that's a male writer. Don't you think that's a male writer?
So is Haruki Murakami.
Yeah, but I think it is a male writer thing.
Yes, I think it's unusual for Barbara Kingsolver to be on the ick register. I think as we go, we're going to have more men.
Well, you see, I give her a leave pass because she's female.
Yeah.
And it's era specific. To me, Peter Temple.
No excuse. Yep.
He's an old white man.
They're both going on the register. We had quite a lot of response to our ick register. We've had all sorts of people sending us words.
I love it.
Moist.
Oh, no.
Moist is on there. Unless you're talking about a cake.
Well, it depends about the context, surely.
So if it's about a cake or maybe the way you've cooked your chicken, probably you're allowed. But anything else, people don't like moist. And there's a few others. But anyway.
I love that. Yes.
We're having a lot of
Definitely want more ickrageous. And I also want, and this is not nowhere near as funny, I'm returning to being serious. I also want people to tell us on Instagram other books that invoke other modern books that invoke Charles Dickens for them.
Yes, yes. Let us know
what you've read that has that, Dickensian.
That brings the Dickens thing to mind, the aesthetic or the social mirror,
yes.
I think, which was very much part of his aim.
Mm.
And just the legacy that he left. There are so many books. I think even just using the funny names.
Yes. Well, we've noticed that in a lot of our Dingo Noir as well, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that Chris Hammer is an author who obviously loves Dickens because he loves to do the great names.
Yeah.
Kate Atkinson does them too a little bit, I think. Occasionally,
yeah.
not as obviously, but contact us on Instagram and let us know because we do love getting that sort of feedback. It's fantastic. So that's it from us today. We hope you enjoyed hearing us chat about Dickens and Demon Copperhead, and let us know any Dickens books that you love. Or if you've read Demon Copperhead, tell us what you thought of it and whether you thought it was a good parallel for David Copperfield. And we will be back again soon.
Bye.
Bye.
We really enjoyed today's episode. Thank you for listening, and thank you for all your lovely reviews too. If you want to know more about today's books or anything else we've talked about, you'll find them in the show notes. And we feature most of the books on our Instagram page too, at diving_in_podcast. And if you'd like to share any books that you've been diving into, we'd love to hear from you. Please email us at hello@divinginpodcast.com. Bye for now.
Breaking off, shaping out, working in, diving in. Breaking off, shaping out, working in, diving in.
Oh, I have to stop because Baloo is playing with my hand and like nibbling it and then batting it with his paw.
He does that when he doesn't want you to stop. So if you pull away, he'll bat it.
Okay, I'll keep going.